Good evening, everybody. Welcome. So tonight, we're going to focus on the first three sections of the Sandokai. But first, I wanted to go back a little bit more over the ancestral lineage, because I find it very interesting to do that whenever I study a new text from one of the ancestors. And I wanted to point out that a good thing to do when you're studying, if you haven't done a lot of studying with these things, is to actually go to the introductory section in the commentaries, where they often have both practitioners and academics, or academic practitioners, give background. And it's always very helpful to me to have that background, because you don't necessarily find it in any of the other texts. So in the Sandokai, Michael Wanger did an introduction and commentary. And he said, not much was known about Sekito's life. The first recorded event is an encounter at the age of 12 with the sixth ancestor, Sester Weining in Chinese and Daikon Enno in Japanese, who lived in the 8th century. When the precious youth approached, he said, Daikon Enno said, "If you become my disciple, you will start to look like ugly like me." Sekito said, "Fine." He stayed with Daikon Enno for 2 years until the master died. And then for the next 15 years, he practiced alone, after which he studied with one of Daikon Enno's disciples, Seigen Gyoshi. So in 742, after Seigen Gyoshi's death, Sekito built a hut on a large stone at Mount Hang in what is now Hunan province. His name, Sekito, means stone head. Interesting when you start looking at his dialogues with other people. So Dogen says, "Great Master Sekito did Zazen on a large rock where he had a thatched hut. He sat continuously without sleeping day and night." So I wanted to introduce you to another text that we Sogen used to love, called The Transmission of the Light. This one is translated by Thomas Cleary. And Thomas Cleary gives the enlightenment stories of all of the great ancestors. And the reason I think it's important to look at that today is because it was after his enlightenment that he wrote the Sandokai. So this is Thomas Cleary's. And it's not very straightforward, so you may find it frustrating. Shito, or Sekito Kisen, called on Master Seigen Gyoshi, who asked him, "Where have you come from?" Shito said, "From Kauki, where Zen Master Weining taught." Seigen Gyoshi held up a whisk and said, "Is there this at Kauki?" Shito said, "Not only not at Kauki, not even in India." Seigen Gyoshi said, "You haven't been to India, have you?" Shito said, "If I had, it would be there." Seigen Gyoshi said, "That's not enough. Say more." Shito said, I don't decline to speak to you, but I'm afraid later on you will not get it." Shito said, "Is it not that they won't get it, but no one can say it. Seigen hit Shito with a whisk, whereupon Shito experienced a great enlightenment. So there's a history of this. In ancient as well as recent times, they have held up a whisk to show a clue or introduction to initiate action, to make people abandon side tricks, or to give people immediate direction. Seigen Gyoshi also did this as a test, but Shito hadn't yet understood what Seigen was calling this, and still fixed his eyes on the raising of the whisk, saying, "Not only at Kauki, not even in India." So what we can see is that Shitu was a little full of himself. I mean, he went to a famous teacher and he said, I don't think you're telling me the right thing. Maybe you need to tell me something a little bit more in some other way." He was really having a hard time getting past being him and all of the factual information. And only when he got the whisk whacked at him did he wake up and leave him and let go of himself and be able to let go of his fixed ideas, and let the experience of just having face-to-face transmission, being warm hand to warm hand transmission. And then he could let go of himself. He could let him his ideas of what this was. What is it? What is this? Is it the whisk? Is it the words? Is it an idea? Is it a practice? It's just this. Just this moment of transmission. So that experience was very, very striking for him. So really, as I say, it feels interesting to me to learn about Sekhetiyo. So as a child, he was really a child at 12. Then he goes and he goes with a great sixth ancestor. Then he goes sits on a rock in a hut for 15 years. He doesn't seem like he is the quickly enlightened person. What we talk later on about people who are fast and people are slow, or people who can can get the Dharma of quick enlightenment versus gradual enlightenment. Well, it seems like 15 years was pretty gradual. So I think that it's interesting that his own life, his own biography, showed that he was, although he impressed his first teacher, Guanyin, as being a sharp, dedicated person who he wanted to invest in energy in, it took him, he also took his time sitting every day for 15 years, maybe. We don't know exactly, but it seems like that's the case. So it's interesting to look at him as an own case study, as is our own case study in the gradual versus the sudden. The gradual can took could take many, many years, and yet the awakening is still wonderful. Or the other way. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. So the first talk the first line or the first this first talk is that says the mind is on the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. I want to return to repeat what Mary talked to us about before we start talking about this. She translated that san means many, do means sameness or oneness. And what that this basically the mind of the great sage of India is great mind or big mind, one's whole being. To completely understand the relationship between one great whole being and the many facets of the great whole being is Kai. To perceive this reality is to see things as they are, or reality as it is with all of its aspects. We also talk of perceiving the ultimate reality as suchness. So things as it is, or suchness, is seeing reality in all of its complexity, in all of its comings and goings. So, I'm going to use some descriptions that Suzuki Roshi talked about in terms of examples. He talked about actually not. He talked about experiences where we are perceiving ourselves or we're perceiving reality. And noticing that we have certain responses to what we see when we name something, we have responses. When we taste something, we have preferences. When we smell something, it smells good or not. We have a concrete ideas that this thing is tastes good and I like this. This is good. This thing tastes bad. I don't like it. That's bad. So we have a lot of experiences when we perceive when we're not using our big mind, we get caught in differences and opinions and likes and dislikes and putting things in boxes and making them separate and not making them part of a whole big picture, not being able to absorb the whole picture. Thinking of particularity rather than the sameness. One example given by Shohaku in his book, Great, was the hand. And Sojin used to do that. He used to think about bodies. He said, if I hold up my hand, you might see it as a hand. And yet you can also see it as five fingers. One hand has five fingers, and there is no hand beyond those fingers. Five fingers and one hand are the same two aspects of one reality. With each hand, each finger is different and even has a different name. The Japanese have a name. We have index finger, thumb, whatever, middle finger. The Japanese have a very particular name for each finger. The fingers are part of the hand. They don't exist separately. So the hand is made up of all these parts, and so is our body. So our whole body is parts, each of which have particular characteristics and functions and are necessary and have to be paid attention to. But we can't see them as separate from the body. They're not separate. They're part of, they're an integral part of. They come and they change. They are also not particularly, they're not solid. So we can't ever know for sure what the characteristics are because the characteristics are changing from day to day. And they all have something else to do with it, with each other. They're all interdependent. They're all influencing each other. Big mind, and when we are looking at big mind, we are looking at all of the aspects of our body mind, all of them, and trying to be as aware and open to them as we can. So when we sit, we're sitting in awareness. We smell, we may taste, we hear, we can touch, we feel hot, we feel cold. We're sitting, all of that. We hear sirens, we hear people yelling at each other, and we just accept that suchness is that this is it. This is it. And it differs from moment to moment. This is it. This is it. This is it. But you can't separate these things out as separate into parts, or you miss the whole. I remember actually, when I was reading this, I was a as I know most of you know, I was a physician, and I taught medical students for many years. And medical students are indefinitely being taught particularities. So we have extensive medical histories and exams and so forth. But often somebody comes in with a particular thing. And so we talk to the person about the thing that they brought us. And we try to sort through it. We ask the questions, where does it hurt? What is it? How long has it been going? Whatever. But if, but what can be a trap in doing that is that you get caught on the particular complaint. And so you don't necessarily see the whole picture. And I had some very interesting experiences because I have several dramatic experiences. People came in, we walked into a room, and the man was having stomach problems and vomiting and all sorts of gastrointestinal problem. And so the medical students came in one by one. They asked very nicely, and they didn't notice that the patient was jaundiced, that his eyes were yellow. No, the person had hepatitis, and but they were asking about digestive system issues, and what? And there was another time when person came in with some chest pain or whatever, and the person was a dwarf, and none of them noticed that the person was a dwarf. They just kept on asking questions about his chest pain. So it's kind of like that. It's like if you don't take in the big picture, if you don't take in the big picture, you can. If you don't take in all of it. So when we have our own observations of our mind, for example, we can get caught on a particular aspect of our mind, a particular feeling, a particular opinion. We can go off into the rabbit hole of getting into that place and get caught in lost in that conceptual opinion or construction and not ever be actually present with the full me, with the full mind. So I think that's really the heart of this. Is really how do we work with ourselves? How do we practice? What is it? What is our zazen? Which is the whole aim of it is to be able to be moment to moment, taking in as broad a field as we can, and then we will begin to see, maybe we begin to notice some associations. We'll begin to notice things, but we don't get lost, get caught in opinions or opinion. I had was talking to people at Wednesday night group. We were talking about the six realms of existence last night, and we were talking about how we navigate the six realms of existence every day. Multiple times, and everybody started talking about their catch points, their stuck points where they hated people at the supermarket who blocked aisles, and it was a pet peeve of theirs. And whenever they went, that they hated to go to Monterey Market because everybody at Monterey Market blocked the lanes.
That's true.
And some people didn't like Berkeley Bowl because they didn't like that Berkeley that they couldn't pay with cash or something like that. They had all these things that were day-to-day stuck points where they were caught. They couldn't let go. They were caught in repetitive patterns. So I thought maybe that's one of the things we could go into a small group about and think about how have you either noticed, not noticed, or dealt with these habitual patterns that keep you from seeing things that is it as it is. Can we do that?
We can. Hi, my name is Mary. Prompt is how do we deal with our habitual patterns of perception? And I think that it sounds like Jerry's example was pet peeves as one. Guess that's one entropy. But I don't know what comes to mind for you.
Hard to focus when I'm trying to. Maybe this is one. But it's hard to focus on seeing everybody else moving.
I don't
Yeah.
know how to
But it's okay. I guess
turn
I'll
them off.
close it.
Yeah.
I mean, two thoughts c came to mind. I've lived at Tassajara for 3 years, and in the most recent time that I was there, I was in the kitchen, and that's, I think, a particularly fruitful place to explore habits and also have the opportunity to experience flow. And the place where the flow could get interrupted for me and for other people was with interpersonal issues, which I think that's like common knowledge about being in the kitchen, if you've been in the kitchen. But one in particular situation there that was interesting had to do with one person that we perceived it. Well, she was new to Tassajara, and she was new to the culture of how we do things there, and also exhibited signs of being highly judgmental. And so there were things that she did in the flow that became very hard to flow with, and also was very hard to speak to, because it would escalate the dynamics. And so the habit pattern there that I experienced, it probably was a habit pattern, was in not essentially calling her on what she was doing and like interrupting it. And I was the Fukuten. So that was part of, part of the role is to engage with those dynamics. And at the same time, I held the way I held it was that you do that with kindness. One does that with kindness. Like that does not have to be an interaction that's cruel or full of scolding. Yeah. So in any case, interestingly, like the place that I think it was a habit pattern, because then I was talking with Rab Anderson about this. And I sunk into just like talking about this person, like it just was like kind of like I was in a mind fog of like she's doing this and she's doing that, and then he interrupted me and he was like, excuse me. And he just did the whack, like it was so wonderful because it woke like it woke me up out of the out of this dilemma that actually several of us in the kitchen who were in leadership roles found ourselves like not really knowing exactly what to do.
It's really hard.
Yeah, and so that was very helpful when Reb did that because it helped me to see the ways in which like the mind reels were going for me too. Yep. So that's one example
It's a great one.
comes to mind.
Yeah, it's a really good one.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's Sangha life. It's, I think it's less intense in the non-residential version that we do, but it exists in the same form. I mean, that people get up one's nose in some way. And I think the advantage from my perception of how, what it's like to be a Tosahara is that you can't, it's not really possible to escape. You can't really try to avoid. The avoidant paths are cut off in a way because of the frequency and continuous contact. And so we have this interesting problem of things festering or not being able to figure out, or them going on for a long time between people and people acquiring. I mean, I think in my own working with myself, it's been important to figure out how not to have fixed views of people. Like, so and so is like this, and they're going to be doing like this, and having these anticipatory responses. Or even viscerally, when I come into some sort of proximity with a person, I could feel my own body changing in almost subtle ways, and going into a watchful mindset about what was going to happen. That was actually being fed by my past experiences, as opposed to nice talking to you. That was
Yeah,
good.
thank you.
So we'll move on to the second talk, warm hand to warm hand. The second talk deals with a longer version of the first. The mind of the great sage of India is inevitably transmitted from west to east. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. Suzuki Roshi starts off by pointing out that Seigen Gyoshi chose Sekito over a great scholar that was also studying with him to receive Dharma transmission first. Even though Sekito had little formal information and spent his time pounding rice in the corner of the temple. He goes on to suggest that there is no difference in value between between the schools of sudden enlightenment and the school with gradual approach. Sojin talked about how we can experience both of these. They come together. There is no there there. Suzuki says to be different is to have value. In this sense, each thing has value and thus is equal to everything else. All things have equal absolute value. He mentions the fact that morality is transient. He talks about certainly an impermanent, and certainly science and philosophy are impermanent, and also we're always changing over time as causes and conditions change. So what is skillful and wholesome at one point can be unwholesome at another point in a different circumstances. So getting back to so the northern and the southern schools, for so the sharp or dull, getting and he reminds us that the northern and south groups made judgments over which had greater wisdom or understanding. Suzuki Roshi brings up that he was not so sharp. Said, I was not so sharp. In fact, his teacher nicknamed him, of course, the we famously Crooked Cucumber. He suggests that there are advantages for both of these. A slow learner takes time and painful effort to master the Dharma, but the sharper ones who quickly learn it quickly forget it. Sojin always referred to the four types of horses, and Suzuki Roshi did too. There, the first horse gallops at the first sign of a whip. The second, when the whip touches his hair. The third, when the whip touches his skin. And the fourth, when the whip penetrates its bones. Which one are you? He said that he and Suzuki agreed that the fourth type often became the best practitioners. So this issue of gradual and sudden as being a marker of smart or dull, you know, that it's or of one type of practice is more is better than another for various reasons, doesn't make any sense in this context that practices are the practices. How we do them, when we do them, when we change them, what circumstances are according to situation. They're according to our own internal situation, what we can do, what we're capable of doing, our mental capacity, our knowledge base. And they're also the what we were exposed to. So any of these practices are as good as the other, basically, is what he's saying. And so there is no what is sharp and what is dull. What horse is the best horse? Is it the best horse who just gets it right away? Anticipates the right thing to do? Is that better? So the other thing that Suzuki Roshi starts to point out here is that really, if everyone has the ability to awaken, it doesn't matter how they get there. We all have the ability to awaken. We can do it whatever way we want, and experiment. So he talks about the concept of potentiality. All beings have the potential for awakening. And he says what we do is we get stuck on time. If we let go of time and thinking that if the smarter people wake up faster, that's best because it means we're smarter and we're capable and we do the practice better. We give up the whole idea of time. We can be generous to ourselves. We can let ourselves go at our own pace, evolve in a natural way. I mean, certainly Sekoto evolved over a very long time. And even in his life before. So the idea is if we can allow ourselves to let go of time and let go of time as a value, fast is better than slow. If we can let go of that, then we are generous with ourselves. And if we're generous to ourselves, we're much more likely to be understanding and generous with everybody else. So we need to look at some specific circumstances. When you study hard, what you receive from your teacher is the spirit of study that is transmitted warm hand to warm hand. You should just do it. That's all, he says. There is no thing to transmit to you, just a path to work with. So there's nothing to get, basically. There isn't anything to get. I get it. Or I had another Kensho. Good for me. That isn't a value. You had another moment of opening up. That doesn't have any value. If it's just moment to moment, being aware, moment to moment, not judging. I think I want to stop there, actually, and have us look at what kind of horse we might be, and what have we observed in our own introspection, in our own observations during Zazen. What have we observed that allows us to open? Have we found how do we find that we drop body mind? When does that happen? When is it? When is it? What are the circumstances? What are the what's the path? What's the practice that suits us, and what are our hindrances for that? Recognizing our potentiality. So maybe we can discuss that.
In small groups
Yeah.
or all together?
Well, we can do it whichever way, I think. Maybe because we'll run out of time, maybe we should do it together.
Either way.
Yeah,
There'll
I
be
think we can
fewer
do it.
people to talk about it if they're a small group, or we can
Yeah.
hear from everybody in a large group.
Well, I
I mean,
think
not
maybe.
everybody, but we
Yeah.
can hear from a few people in a large group.
Yeah, I think let's go into group again and look at, are we sharp or dull? How do we see ourselves, sharp or dull? What kind of horse we are? What are hindrances to opening to the practice without judgment?